Hello, I'm Simon Wakely, and welcome to this month's edition of Changing the World with CSU Researchers, the show produced for 2MCE by the Researcher Development Team in the Office of Research Services at Charles Sturt University. The aim of our programme is to showcase the amazing and diverse work being done by doctoral students at CSU, and in today's show you'll hear from two such students, Rabin Dalal and Bron Williams. I don't think it's possible to find two more different pieces of research than the ones you'll hear about over the next half an hour. In the second half of the programme, we'll be hearing about bias, shame, and the work of an early Christian philosopher. First, though, we speak to Rabin Dalal and find out more about his work relating to artificial intelligence and cattle identification.
My name is Rabin Dalal. I'm a second-year PhD student in the Faculty of Business, Justice and Behavioral Science in the School of Computing, Mathematics and Engineering in Charles Sturt University. My title of the research is Efficient Cattle Identification Through Active Learning. I am a recipient of Food Agility CRC Full Scholarship, and my research is conducting with industry partner called Terra Cypher, which is based in Brisbane.
To start with, I asked Rabin to provide some context. What exactly is the problem his work is trying to solve?
My field of interest is object identification, which is a subtopic of artificial intelligence. And currently, I'm working to fill the research gap in cattle identification by the use of object identification techniques. Well, cattle identification is significant in livestock management with applications in biosecurity, food supply chain, tracking and keeping the cattle records, controlling cattle trafficking, controlling theft, and many other things. The traditional method of cattle identification are branding, ear notching, ear tagging. These traditional methods are labor intensive and also harming the cattle through infections and other contaminations because they involve different activities like cutting body parts, hitting the iron rod and burning the body parts. In the recent years, some researchers talk about identifying cattle with iris pattern, retina image pattern, muzzle pattern, DNA patterns, body coat patterns, and some radio frequency identification technology. But capturing images of retina and iris pattern make those systems methods difficult. And implementing DNA patterns needs specialized labs, and the result is not obtained instantly. While coat patterns are the distinct color combination of the fur presented on the body of the cattle, this method can be implemented in the cattle having different body colors. But in case of our cattle, we have a Angus breed who have the black body color, and this type of coat pattern cannot be implemented in the Angus breed cattle. While RFID, radio frequency identification based ear tag, is an electronic method that includes a chip in the ear tag, and all the information about the cattle, like eyes, movement, weight, and vaccination records, there are stored in the chip of the RFID system. So in Australia, the current standard is the RFID-based National Livestock Identification System, which is based on RFID technology. But the defect of the RFID technology is it can be duplicated, it can be lost, damaged, and they are vulnerable to attacks. Like, just imagine if someone altered the analyzed ear tag of the contaminated cattle with healthy cattle, the contaminated cattle will be recognized as healthy cattle. And if the cattle loses the analyzed tag, it can be difficult to re-identify the cattle and re-tag the previous information.
So that's the problem that Rabin's research is trying to address. What's his solution?
I'm using muzzle pattern because muzzle patterns are unique patterns like human fingerprint. And research in animal science shows that when the eyes of cattle grows, the size of muzzle changes, but the pattern remains unchanged. The capturing the muzzle images is easier than capturing iris and the retina images of the cattle. While from the existing research, in cattle identification using muzzle pattern, machine learning and deep learning methods, they are a part of artificial intelligence. They show promising results. However, to implement the industry, we have to consider various industry-related scenarios like illumination of the muzzle image, occlusion, and the different lighting conditions, like sometimes the cattle are inside the yard, sometimes outside the yard, and sometimes we have to face the sunny day and the, sometimes in the cloudy day. So this research aims to provide solution to different lighting and environmental difficulties.
Rabin explains his methodology for the research.
I'm using the data of the muzzle images captured from CSU farm here in Wagga Wagga. And also I'm using some publicly available data to develop a machine learning or deep learning based model for identification. The methodology of my research has three basic stages. In the first stage, I'm doing the detection of the muzzle or the location of the muzzle within the image of the cattle. And in the second stage, I'm doing extracting the necessary information, useful information from the detected muzzle, which is called feature extraction, and fusing those extracted features, and followed by the third stage to develop an identification system. While the model will be capable to identify the cattle in photo or video form, if the muzzle is clear and visible.
As we've heard, this is an ambitious multi-phase project. So where is Rabin up to now?
I'm a second year student. But in the first year, I was working with an industry called TerraCypher. And we had a project called TrackCard. And for that project, I developed a deep learning model. So that with that deep learning model, we tested some images from the CSU farm. And we collected the images from CSU farm, and I trained the model with that images, and I developed the cattle recognition system based on the muzzle images. So that was the first part. And in the second and the third part, I am focusing in to develop more robust system. However, the system I developed in the first year, that had some limitations. So in the coming year, the second and third year, I am focusing to solve the limitations of the system that I developed before.
So what does a normal day of research involve for a PhD like this? Is it, like I imagine, mostly computer coding?
Yeah, mostly the coding. And the second thing is the collection of data is the most important thing for every data science or the machine learning, this deep learning based applications, because if we can teach the machine with the good data, the machine can get a lot more information from the good data, and the performance of the system is really depending on the quality of the data. So in my daily life, I think to cure the data, like when I collect some of the thousands of images in the farm, and the most of the images, they are unwanted. They have the blur, some have the blocked portion of the images, and they have the poor quality of the image. So the first thing is the collecting and curing of the data so that I can get the high quality data. And the second thing is the coding. I take the data that I collected, that I prepared, and in the coding, I use that data, make the computer to learn about the data. And the third is the after the computer learns something information from the data, and I give some of the testing images so that how good my model is working. If the testing images I give to the model is predicting exactly the same result, predicting the correct result, then I feel that the coding or the system I developed is in the right way. Or if I get something error, or if I get the misidentification, then I have to work into the coding part so that I have to fix how to make the computer to learn and to detect in a right way.
To finish my discussion with Rabin, I asked him about the potential impact of his work.
Well, yeah, it's a big impact, in, especially in Australia, because Australia's red meat industry has a more than 67, 68 billion annual turnover. So this is a very big industry. So this type of biometric identification is very important, because if we think about the if someone intentionally do some theft, like I read one news in the in Queensland. Actually, in Queensland, a lot of cattle in every year, they were trafficked by some people. So in the farm, so many cattle they lost every year. So Queensland police is also looking for some of these robust systems so that they can track about the cattle with the whose cattle were theft from which farm. Currently, the analyze your tag. When you remove the tag from the cattle, the system has no information about which cattle is being trafficked or which cattle is being theft. So if we substitute the analyze your tag with this biometric system, so that we have all of the cattle's record in a computer system, and if someone traffic their own cattle from Queensland to, let's say, the other region of the country, when we click the picture of that muzzle and upload the muzzle in the system will automatically show what cattle is exactly, what is the identity of that cattle, which the farm the cattle belongs to, and all of the information about this in the system. So this is not only for the cattle identification. So the cattle identification is directly related to the food supply. Like if you go to the restaurant and we order some food, we have to ensure that the food we get that is not the contaminated food. The meat we order, if we get from the restaurant, we get from the plate, we have to ensure that the cattle is healthy. The cattle has no sign of any disease, so that it's not only related to the cattle safety, it is related to the whole community. So if we can implement this sort of thing, we can really help the red meat industry as well as we can help the community.
Thanks very much, Rabin, and we wish you the best of luck with this important research. Our next guest is Bron Williams. She introduces herself and explains her PhD project.
Hi, I'm Bron Williams. I am studying in the Arts and Education faculty in the School of Theology, and I am exploring the intersection between bias and shame. I'm a speaker, so a professional keynote speaker and a mentor for women. I'm helping and guiding women to rediscover their power and reconnect with their power, because I have observed, certainly in my own life and in other women, that we give up our power far too readily. In the work that I do, I have been looking at the field of unconscious bias, particularly during the pandemic, because a lot of our biases became very, very obvious. But what I observed, and as I spoke with people, was that there was always a sense of shame around recognizing bias. And one of the things that I was doing in my work was trying to counteract that, saying bias is simply part of how we think. It forms when we're very young. We don't actually have a lot of control over its formation. Therefore, we should not feel ashamed of it. We might feel ashamed of some of our less than desirable behaviours. However, of the bias itself, I don't feel that shame is a necessary emotion. So that got me thinking. And as I spoke with people and said, look, I'd like to do this, all I got was affirmation, was yes, this needs to be explored. And so that's where I started. And because I have I've done my degree in the field of theology, I was at one point a Salvation Army officer, I went back to the School of Theology to do this. And now I'm looking at Augustine of Hippo, who is an ancient Christian philosopher, but who has had influence over a lot of thought. And so, yeah, tying the ancient and the new together.
We'll come back to Augustine of Hippo in a minute or two. First, though, we need to unpack what we mean by the term bias.
I try to keep the definition really simple, that bias is simply the privileging of one set of ideas or one group of people to exclusion of another. And our biases form very early in childhood from input from our families, sporting groups, the media, the government, so many different ways. Maybe our faith group will be also another area. And what that does is that then bias informs how we see the world, how we see other people, how we see ourselves, who we may instinctively trust and who we might innately distrust or show disregard to. And although bias is largely unconscious, we can find ways to notice when it's occurring, and that's part of the work that I do, is help people become aware of biases and then to mitigate the risks. For myself, I had no idea about unconscious bias 10 years ago when I was working with the Salvation Army, and I worked with the asylum seekers on Nauru in the offshore processing centre there. But it was during that time, as a very conservative person grown up in a very white Australia with a strong Christian heritage, there I am on a Pacific island in the middle of a refugee camp. And I was confronted, unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, with my own latent racist bias. And that wasn't anything that I had overtly encouraged. It was just something out of my childhood, this whole idea that difference was a threat. And when I started to see that in myself, of course, once you start to see one thing, you see other things. And I noticed how the white expats on the island were treating the Nauruan staff, being dismissive of their ideas and thinking that we knew best. It was like, well, after all, I come from a developed country and I have a university education, therefore I do know best. And when I spoke with one of the women who was heading up the Nauruan team for the Salvation Army and said, look, this is what I'm observing, she just said, we know that about you guys, but we just accept it. And so that reinforced for me that this whole notion of white privilege, which I didn't know about before then, but I had to go and learn about, was actually real. So they're two simple biases that many of us will come up against. But of course, there's things like ageist bias. You know, we can have an ageist bias against ourselves. I'm too old to be doing this, or I'm too young. Or we can have, obviously, there's sexist bias, you know, that women can or cannot do certain things. And certainly the whole narrative around transgender and LGBTQI, there are biases around that as well. So they're the sort of fairly common ones.
As promised, let's focus now on Augustine of Hippo. I asked Bron to tell us who he was and how his work is relevant to her research.
Augustine wrote in the 300s, so very sort of early on, both in Christian history and in Western history in the modern era. And because he wrote prolifically over his lifetime, and because the Christian church then largely went on to be the church of the Western world, and the thought of the Christian church influenced lawmaking and, you know, societal norms so much, because he is one of the most significant writers in Christianity, his work has actually, because of the nature of how Christianity spread and became normalized across the Western world, his ideas, therefore, have infiltrated and come down through the centuries, nearly 2,000 years, that, you know, his ideas and thoughts have been very much part of our thinking, even when we don't recognise it. So that's one of the reasons that I believe Augustine's a really good person to have as a, you know, an interlocutor, somebody to go back to and talk with. However, in terms of bias and shame, while Augustine doesn't actually ever use the word bias, and I don't even think it was a concept, he did understand that the mind was like this vast expanding universe, in a sense, that there was so much there that he didn't understand. And I've chuckled over many of the things that Augustine has written, because I thought you could pick him up and put him down in a barbecue in Australia and he'd fit right in. He has a really wicked sense of humour at times. And, so it's been really interesting seeing his thought that can be transferred to today. But he has his own biases. Like, he grew up in a particular time in history, particularly where women were not given any place of equality. And he also has an educational bias. He was from the Platonic school of thought. And so that's after Plato. And he was a classical scholar. And there was a lot of pride around being a classical scholar. And if you weren't a classical scholar, your thoughts were not particularly of any value. So there's this sort of bias towards classic scholarship and his own education. There was a bias against women that was very normal for his time. And then he also talks a lot about shame. He wrote a series of books called The City of God. There are 22 books in the series. And in book 14, he speaks a lot about shame connected with the Genesis story of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and the apple and the snake and, you know, all those imageries, which I think most people are reasonably familiar with, even if they've got no sort of faith basis to their lives. But what he is particularly focusing on in terms of shame is the whole area of nakedness and sexuality and sex as a physical function and lust and passion, because he had his own issues with those things in his own life, and he was ashamed of some of his own behaviours to women. And so what I observe is that he transfers his own shame onto a biblical narrative and then in many ways sets a standard and says, this is how we should view sex, this is how we should view this narrative. And in a sense, normalises things. And because of his influence, a lot of his thoughts have come with us down the years. And I still think there are issues with sex in our world.
Earlier, we heard how a typical day for Rabin is mainly computer programming. I suspect Bron spends her days in rather different activities. I asked her to describe the kind of work she does.
Over the last 18 months, I've read about 83 different pieces of information. That's ranged from books like The City of God, which is 22 books, through to downloadable PDFs. So that has been my task and will continue to be my task for the next couple of years. We'll be doing what I call the paper chase, or what my supervisor calls going on a fishing trip. And both of them have this idea of you don't actually know where you're going yet. And I love that. Like, I've got an idea. I have this sense that bias and shame are linked. But I want to look at the literature. So mine is totally literature-based. So rather than just having a literature review and then all the data, mine is basically going to be a whole literature review and then my conclusions that I'm going to be drawing out of that. So I will spend, and I have spent probably 3 months this year just reading the City of God books and taking notes. I'd use a lovely system called Trello where I can either use voice typing or I can type in manually a quote out of the book, make some comments, and it just comes up as a separate card on each list in Trello. And that's really helpful because what it allows me to do is to keep all the information that I have at this stage found to be useful or pertinent in one place so that when, as I'm in the process of doing now, I'm starting to get my proposal together, I'm starting to get some writing down, I can then go back and go, okay, I remember I read about, and I go and look down one of the Trello lists, and I can go and look and see, well, okay, does that actually help? Can I take that? And quite often then I will literally just put in a whole lot of quotes and then shift them around and then make them into sentences. So, yeah, it's very much all about words, about forming a story or a pattern, and trying to keep as open mind as I can, because although I have an idea of where I'm going to go, I need to be aware that the literature may not go where I think it will go, and I need to be open to that.
The research Bronner's described is undoubtedly intellectually fascinating, but what about its real-world impact?
I suppose because I'm interested in people. I've always been fascinated in people and how we think and why we do the things that we do. And, you know, I start with trying to understand myself better. And, you know, I'm really pleased that I've got to the age that I have, and hopefully I've got quite a number of years left to just get to know myself better and better. But what I want to be able to do is to take two areas that we don't talk a lot about. We don't talk a lot about bias, or if we do, and this has been my observation a lot, is that in, say, in a workplace or a corporate environment, people do some unconscious bias training. They tick the box and they're done, but they actually haven't dealt with or put things into place to deal with the actual biases that are showing up in the workplace, the actual racism, the actual sexism, the actual ageism. So, and that's because we don't want to deal. This is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable talking about bias, and it's also uncomfortable talking about shame. So I'm taking two things, a way of thinking, which is bias, and an emotion, which is shame, and both of which like to stay hidden, and I'm bringing them to the light and saying, I actually think these are connected. And if we can bring both of them into the light, we can deal with them and be, I think, healthier human beings. So I suppose that's really my ultimate aim, is to help people be healthier and wholer, more whole, so that we are not running around in a sense like a chook with its head cut off going, I don't know why I'm behaving the way I do, am. Actually giving some framework for people and saying, this is part of your thinking, this is part of your emotions, they're working together. And if we can understand that, we can understand why we do things.
That's almost it for today's show. To finish our discussion, Bronn shared a quotation that she'd read that she feels really validates her work.
Well, there was one quote that this quote actually really sparked in me that I was on the right track. So one of my supervisors suggested that I look at Augustine, and another one suggested that I look at a contemporary theologian, Willie James Jennings, who's an African-American, and he's written a book called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. So looking a lot at the link between Christianity and how Christianity moved through the world and how that impacted race and the whole idea of whiteness. And he wrote this: the black body presented the shame concealed inside whiteness. And when I read those words, the shame concealed inside whiteness, I thought, here's someone who's actually seeing what I see, that whiteness, which is just a bias, just a privileging of those of us who with light colored skins over those who have darker colored skins, that there was a shame concealed inside that notion of whiteness. And I thought, someone has seen this too. And so I knew I was on the right track.
A huge thank you to Bronn, and also, of course, to Rabin for their contributions to today's programme. We look forward to seeing the outputs of their research over the next few years. We'll be back next month on 2MCE with another edition of Changing the World with CSU Researchers. So until then, bye-bye.